Chapter 2. Hindsight just isn't what it used to be. As with all monumental fuck-ups, it was no one's fault, or at least there was no one eager to own their share of the blame. Former Republican Congressman Denny Rehberg and I had been dancing around the question for an hour. It was the only question that mattered. "Knowing what you know now," I began. We had talked about the Strategic National Stockpile and his role in cutting its funding, about the Tea Party budget battles a decade before the pandemic, about that time he'd played drums alongside Skunk Baxter of the Doobie Brothers for a fundraiser at the Hard Rock Cafe. We covered the Obama administration, cattle ranching in the Rockies, the Affordable Care Act, about how he used his wealth to bring Popeye's chicken to his home state. Some of the questions I asked the retired representative from Montana were tough. Others, not so much. He had answered with the self-assurance of someone who'd spent his life in the public eye, in state government and in Congress, as a villain in unflattering headlines, and a hero in others. But it was the obvious hypothetical that threw him. "What would you do," I asked, "if you had to do it all over again?" "If we only had stuff to do all over again," he said. "What would we do differently?" "Yeah, that's an interesting question. It's been probably debated in a lot of different arenas." Our arena was specific. I was asking if he regretted his part in Congress's cuts to funding for the Strategic National Stockpile, whose depleted stores of emergency equipment a decade later proved a devastating barrier to protecting healthcare workers from a contagion, and which spawned a madcap national hunt for medical supplies. "Hindsight just isn't what it used to be," he continued, an awkward chuckle piping through the phone. "Let's refresh our memories." It was 2011, in Washington, D.C., amid a partisan war that hadn't yet gone nuclear. After winning control of the House amid the Tea Party wave, Republicans had united to combat anything then-President Barack Obama tried to do. Atop the kill list was the Affordable Care Act, Obama's defining legislation, passed the year before when the Democrats controlled Congress. The ACA, or Obamacare, sought to bring health care benefits to millions of Americans through an expansion of federal health insurance programs and a subsidized private exchange. Even though Obamacare was projected to lower the nation's overall health care costs and decrease the national deficit, Republicans opposed it, citing a philosophical devotion to small government and minimal taxes. They resolved to use the power of the purse to thwart the Obama administration, especially at the agency that would administer the expensive and unwieldy program, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, HHS. With control of just one chamber, Republicans couldn't directly dismantle Obamacare. They could, however, hold the entire government hostage. Led by House Speaker John Boehner and Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republicans tipped the scale by leveraging the debt ceiling. In years prior, raising the debt ceiling, a limit on the amount of debt the U.S. Treasury can take on, was perfunctory. It occurred typically without debate to allow the Treasury to keep borrowing and paying the country's obligations. But in 2011, Republicans created a standoff, saying if Democrats didn't agree to spending reductions equal to an increase in the debt ceiling, they'd refuse to raise it. Refusing to raise the government's ability to pay its bills would force a government shutdown and place the country itself on the path to defaulting on its debt, likely decimating the broader economy and job markets. It was a significant threat not just to Democrats, but to the nation. This standoff forced Obama and congressional Democrats to agree to a compromise, the 2011 Budget Control Act. It allowed a temporary increase of the debt ceiling and formed a bipartisan supercommittee to find ways to drive down spending. If that supercommittee failed to agree to major cuts, the bill would trigger automatic across-the-board cuts at just about every government agency, known as sequestration. This ticking time bomb was conceived to force some sort of compromise, because no one in their right mind wanted sequestration. This assumed right minds prevailed in Washington. The Republicans' top target, HHS, is a sprawling umbrella agency presiding over not just social welfare programs and Obamacare, but less contested functions, such as the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the National Institutes of Health, and the Food and Drug Administration. And nestled deep down in this budget, where discretionary spending for countless government functions are delineated, are many programs that most Americans don't know about, don't care about, and if all goes well, don't need to learn about. Among them, the Strategic National Stockpile. Originally housed under the CDC, it was at first a limited repository for vaccines and drugs that either needed to be hoarded away as insurance or because manufacturers would stop making them without continued government investment. It was born of science fiction, inspired at least in part by former President Bill Clinton's reading of a Richard Preston novel in the late 1990s about a terrifying virus that vexed scientists. Clinton had sought the counsel of real-life scientists, who advised it was a good idea to prepare for outbreaks of a novel virus or biological attack. Nature has all sort of untold terrors lying in wait. The stockpile's earliest work involved building an inventory of push packs ahead of the Y2K scare, supplies that could be dispatched anywhere in the country in 12 hours to respond to a crisis somehow wrought by a bunch of ones and zeros. The stockpile played a small role in the response to the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks and the subsequent anthrax letter attacks, events that sent its funding upward amid rising fears of biological terrorism. The stockpile's role would expand under Presidents George W. Bush and Obama, both of whom recognized the need to prepare for an inevitable pandemic, where supply chains can disintegrate and basic equipment like masks and gloves become precious commodities. Its mission was creeping, and in the early days, so too was the stockpile's funding, thanks to bipartisan support for the notion that it would be ideal to mitigate deaths in the event of a contagion. By 2011, oversight of the national stockpile fell to a House subcommittee, controlled by Rehberg, which marked up spending bills and reported them to the full House Appropriations Committee. Such committees are the first stop where legislative dreams can live or die. It's in these hearings where the president's lofty budgets crash into political reality and personalities. Rehberg is a Republican of a bygone era. This is not to say he wasn't as right-leaning as, say, Ted Cruz plays on Fox News when he isn't absconding to Cancun. This is to say it was just easier to tell what Rehberg actually believed. From Billings, Montana, Rehberg is your archetypal rural conservative, mustachioed, and often wearing flannel or an earth-toned blazer, concerned foremost with matters of the wallet and home rule. A fifth-generation rancher, he had earned his GOP bona fides the Western way, with a story of bootstrapping wealth and on-the-ground politicking. After working as a staffer in the Montana State Senate and a stint working for a congressman in D.C., Rehberg returned to ranching, at one point overseeing 500 cattle and 600 goats. In the mid-1980s, Rehberg was elected and served in the state legislature. By the early 1990s, he had been appointed and later elected Montana's lieutenant governor, where he argued inside all 56 Montana counties that local governance was the best governance. It seemed obvious then that Rehberg's political ethos left little room for expensive federally controlled programs with no obvious benefit to him or his constituents. For instance, in January 1994, when he was still lieutenant governor, Rehberg told a group of county commissioners during a discussion about health care, "The problem with AIDS is, you get it, you die. So why are we spending any money on people that get it when we can't even take care of the people who we can fix because we don't have enough money? Yet society has made the determination that we are going to spend money on AIDS. He later said his comment was taken out of context. But the quote struck at his rationale of how budgets work. Something's got to lose. As well, I suppose it said something about his thinking on public health responses to epidemics. In 2000, Rehberg won Montana's sole seat in the U.S. House of Representatives. Over six terms, he supported and introduced the era's popular conservative measures, such as cuts to CDC funding for HIV/AIDS programs in favor of abstinence-only education, and reforms that environmentalist groups said catered to oil and gas industry at the expense of public lands. He also targeted Pell Grants, which helped poor students pay for a college education, and the free school lunch program, which enables poor children to eat. That they were popular and very visible programs didn't, in Rehberg's view, preclude them from being scrutinized. Nothing was off the table. Everything could be on the chopping block. By 2011, Rehberg's committee focused in on the Obama administration's budget request for HHS. The administration asked for $892 billion for the entire HHS enterprise. And tucked in there was a request for about $655 million for the national stockpile. That was about $59 million more than the previous year. An increase the Obama administration said would help replenish supplies and pharmaceuticals that had expired or been doled out to states in response to the H1N1 swine flu epidemic of 2009. Relative to the administration's total request for HHS, the stockpile accounted for just 0.073% of spending. Chump change. As Republicans forced Democrats to negotiate deep spending cuts, Rehberg authored legislation that set the floor for funding the stockpile at $522.5 million, about $132 million less than Obama requested, and about a 12% cut overall. This promised to strain the stockpile's ability to, well, stockpile. The Senate offered more, and in a compromise bill between the two chambers, Congress approved just $534 million, about a 10% cut from the prior year. It was the first substantial cut to the stockpile since its funding stabilized after September 11th, and its funding wouldn't recover until the coronavirus claimed its first victims in the United States in early 2020. This marked the beginning of a ratchet effect. The next year, the two parties failed to come to a budget compromise, and mandatory sequestration cuts forced the Obama administration to decide where to spread the pain. At the CDC, it was 5% across the board. As part of a wide array of cuts, in 2012, the administration proposed deeper cuts to the stockpile, a decrease of $48 million. A year after he pushed to lower the stockpile's funding, Rehberg now questioned the decreased funding. "Disaster preparedness is something that has been very important to me," Rehberg said during a budget hearing he led in March 2012. "And I noticed that the president's budget proposes a reduction in the strategic national stockpile by 9%, or $48 million, in the fiscal year 2013. I just would like to have you explain how such a large reduction can possibly not impact the national preparedness posture." Kathleen Sebelius, Obama's HHS secretary, responded but didn't quite answer. "The budget request will allow the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to replace the high-priority expiring countermeasures, such as smallpox and antibiotics for the treatments of anthrax. In other words, facing forced austerity and brinkmanship, the federal government chose to focus what funding it maintained on expensive medical treatments for a potential but unlikely biological attack, not for restocking frontline defenses to an inevitable viral pandemic. Supplies such as respirators and masks, ventilators, and testing supplies. In the years to come, that philosophy would send hundreds of millions of dollars that could have gone to pandemic preparedness instead to one pharmaceutical company, that increased prices on its anthrax cocktail as it edged out competitors and held the stockpile captive to its demands. The next year, facing another manufactured budget crisis aimed at the ACA, the Obama administration proposed an additional $38 million in cuts to the stockpile, though it acknowledged reduction could result in fewer people receiving treatment during an influenza pandemic. And thus, nominal savings were achieved at an extraordinary cost. Republicans may point to 2012, when Democrats began defunding the stockpile. Democrats may point to the hostage negotiation that set it off the year before. Americans should point to all of the above. For in this way, the shameful and enduring failure to prepare for COVID-19 is among the most consequential bipartisan accomplishments of the 21st century. I was beginning to annoy Rehberg, as is my nature. "You're asking the same question six different ways," Rehberg said. "We're sort of trained to do that," I responded. "The reason it matters is, setting politics aside, there's a narrative either way on who owns the onus of trimming the stockpile. Was it the Obama administration? Was it this Tea Party wave and an Appropriations Act that was, you know, just one of many? Or was it a little bit of both? I'm genuinely interested. If we could have predicted this situation, we might have made a different decision," Rehberg said, relenting, only to add a qualifier. "But based upon the decision at the time, I took the recommendation of the Obama administration. Yeah, so maybe they missed it. Maybe they didn't see COVID coming. In fact, it was predicted voluminously and repeatedly with clarity and understanding from both parties. Starting in 2003, the Government Accountability Office had warned that the nation and states need to study supply chains and stockpile pandemic response gear. In 2005, President George W. Bush read about the 1918 so-called Spanish flu, and it scared the hell out of him. His administration soon drafted a 17-page playbook dubbed the National Strategy for Pandemic Influenza and called for $7.1 billion in emergency spending. A key piece of that strategy included ensuring that the national stockpile and state stockpiles had caches of personal protective equipment such as masks and gloves. The next year, in May 2006, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office released an assessment of the potential costs of a national pandemic. Many of the conclusions were drawn from an outbreak of an earlier mysterious coronavirus, first observed in China in the early 2000s. This coronavirus caused severe acute respiratory syndrome and was thus named SARS-CoV-1. It had at this point been contained after killing nearly 800 people worldwide, a fraction of the millions that would perish years later to its viral relative, SARS-CoV-2, which causes COVID-19. That report foretold that hospitals' cost-saving practice of foregoing large inventories of supplies for on-demand supply shipments, a so-called just-in-time strategy, would create a nightmarish scramble for supplies. The urgent need to stock up and prepare was again brought to the fore in 2009, when the Obama administration worked to contain the H1N1 swine flu epidemic, which killed an estimated 12,000 Americans. The administration had doled out to states and hospitals about 75% of its entire supply of N95 respirators and about a quarter of its less effective face masks to help stop the virus. Its inventory would not recover. What remained was left to expire and rot in federal warehouses. Following H1N1, by all accounts, nature's warning shot, the CDC commissioned a study that outlined in stark terms just how screwed we'd be if we didn't replenish emergency response supplies. The study made sweeping observations about likely breakdowns between local, state, and federal agencies. It now reads like prophecy. Delays and conflicts in federal guidance on respiratory protection, N95, led to confusion, scientists wrote a decade before COVID-19. States experience significant challenges with the N95 supply chain. There should be a central repository of N95s which is replenished for future events. Yet, the very next year, beginning in Reberg's committee, lawmakers from both parties, with this information in their hands, politics on their minds, their eyes open wide to the consequences, allowed our first line of defense to wither.